Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte. The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's WORKLAB, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China. In this program, we'll look at books, ideas, new research, intellectual currents, and cultural trends that can help us better understand what's happening in China's politics, foreign relations, economics, and society. Join me each week for in-depth conversations that shed more light and bring less heat to the way we think and talk about China. Seneca is supported this year by the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a national resource center for the study of East Asia. The Seneca podcast will remain free, but if you work for an organization that believes in what I am doing with the podcast, please consider lending your support. You can get me at senecapod@gmail.com. And listeners, please support my work on Substack at seneca.substack.com. There you'll find, in addition to the podcast, the complete transcript of the show, a weekly essay from me, and now a wide range of other offerings, including James Carter's This Week in China's History, Paul French's Ultimate China Bookshelf, Andrew Methvin's Chinese Phrase of the Week, and the outstanding China Global South podcast, as well as a weekly essay from the brilliant and deeply informed folks at the China Global South Project. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you this week from Seattle, Washington. This week on Seneca, I am delighted to welcome Tom Fingar and David Lampton, two gentlemen who are well known, I dare say, to many of the listeners. Thomas Fingar is Shorenstein A. Park Fellow in the Freeman Smoglie Institute for International Studies at Stanford. He was Assistant Secretary of State for Intelligence and Research. He served as the first Deputy Director of National Intelligence for Analysis and as Chairman of the National Intelligence Council. And he's the author of many books, including most recently, From Mandate to Blueprint, Lessons from Intelligence Reform. Thomas, Tom, if I may, welcome to Seneca.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting us.
Hey, thank you. David M. Lampton, Mike, as he's known, is Professor Emeritus and former Hyman Professor and Director of SAIS China and China Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and Senior Research Fellow at the Foreign Policy Institute. Mike was also formerly President of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations. His latest of several books is called Living U.S.-China Relations, From Cold War to Cold War, published just a couple of months ago. Mike Lampton, welcome to Seneca.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Kaiser.
Well, great. Mike, I have my copy of Living U.S.-China Relations, but I have a hard and fast rule against interviewing anyone about a book that I haven't read cover to cover. As soon as I finish, I hope to have you back on the program for a deep dive into that. But what I have read, and have read now quite a number of times, is a paper that the two of you co-authored in the Winter 2024 edition of the Washington Quarterly. The paper is titled China's America Policy, Back to the Future. And as brief as it is nonetheless one of the most compelling diagnoses and set of prescriptions that I've seen for what ails the bilateral relationship. If I didn't emphasize the importance of strategic empathy or cognitive empathy, it wouldn't be an episode of Seneca, right? This is a recurrent theme for me, and this paper does that extraordinarily well. It really captures how American policy, as perceived by Beijing, I should emphasize, has been a major driver, but importantly, by no means the only, and maybe not even the biggest driver, of Chinese behavior. I think it right-sizes, at least in my own estimation, the part played by American behavior and does an excellent job in highlighting the important domestic Chinese drivers of their foreign policy and of their handling of the relationship as well. Just as an aside here, gentlemen, since I don't know who contributed what to this paper, I'm going to just sort of put my questions to both of you, and whoever wants to jump in.
We don't know that either anymore. We had a mind meld by the end.
Fantastic, yeah. Yeah, the Vulcan mind meld. It's a good thing. So yeah, feel absolutely free to just jump in for whatever I ask. But let me begin with this. You start off by identifying some of the prevailing caricatures of PRC policies, caricatures that you describe in the paper as inaccurate, unhelpful, and counterproductive. So let's talk through what some of these are and why they're pernicious. And let me start by asking you about the first one that you raise, which is about nomenclature, really, about our use of the word autocracy in describing China's party-state system. You say that the word is technically accurate, but more misleading than helpful for explaining PRC behavior. What's your objection to this? Isn't China an autocracy?
Well, I'll take the first whack and Mike can jump in. Of course it is an autocracy, but to say that China or any other state is an autocracy doesn't really tell you anything very useful about why it does what it does, how it prioritizes the challenges it faces, the lenses through which it views the actions and statements of another party. It's a description. It's not an explanation.
Right.
Yeah, I guess if I'd contribute to that, I'd say a couple things. I think one of the big achievements, really, of Nixon and Mao, if you go back, was they took ideology as much as they could out of the bilateral discussion. And I think when you introduce sort of the character of the political system as the defining feature that defines your relationship, in effect, when you dichotomize as we are now, democracy, autocracy, implies we really can't deal with China constructively unless it changes its political system. Well, I think no government, no society is going to accept the precondition of talking to you if regime change is your ultimate objective. So I think that kind of phraseology puts it in a very zero-sum way. Also, it exaggerates, I think, we both live in complex societies with many interest groups. It's not always so easy to see what the groups are and how they interact in each of our societies, but we're each pluralized societies. And I think we have to each speak to and behave towards the other in the recognition that they have their own complexity. And I don't think the dichotomy autocracy and democracy get you very far if that's your objective.
Right. So it's a sort of implicit imputation of illegitimacy every time we use the word. And when we impute illegitimacy, we're basically saying our normative preference would be for you to be overthrown. And so, right, it's sort of connotes a desire for regime change.
Even sharper, I think, extension of the point Mike just made, that premising interaction on a statement or definition that it's an autocracy translates into everything that it does is bad. Anything that it wishes to do is intended to undermine us. And that's demonstrably not the case.
That's right. So that is one of the goals that the use of that word suggests. There's another one that you see so often in the political science literature now, and it's this idea that the party exists only to perpetuate itself in power. That is something that Isa Ding, who is a professor at Northwestern, has written about. I'm going to actually have her on the show in a forthcoming episode to talk about her idea. She has a great word for this propensity. She calls it authoritarian teleology, right? Where everything that they do is assumed to be only for the end of keeping the party in power. That is not to suggest that a lot of stuff that they do isn't for that purpose, but not everything, right?
Well, I think there's a problem, and that is, let's just for a second say, their principal objective is to perpetuate their power. that still raises the question of what do they think they have to do in order to do that? And a lot of it may be feed the Chinese right. people. It may provide a social safety net. It may be give young people the opportunity to get wider exposure in the world and enhance their career objectives and bring talent back to China. Right. Any number of things. So even if your objective is to perpetuate yourself, that could lead you to take actions that are not always inconsistent with the population you're governing.
That's exactly right. Your paper attempts something else that I think a lot of us find challenging, and that is getting Xi Jinping's actual role in China's policy decisions right. How much of this comes from him personally? I think even a lot of very experienced observers don't really always get this right. I think we're in danger right now of overestimating, certainly not of underestimating, how much Xi actually calls every shot. I mean, conventional wisdom now sees him as some kind of all-powerful man who's just surrounded by these, you know, toadies and yes-men, and he's able to impose his personal will as no other Chinese leader since Mao, as we so often hear. But the abolition of term limits, I mean, his elevation as core, the inclusion of Xi Jinping's thoughts in the party constitution as sort of, you know, canon, these all do suggest that he's more than primus inter pares. What would you point to, though, as examples of recent policies where there have been curbs or limits to his autocratic power?
Well, I'll take the first shot, and then Mike can expand and correct what I say. But I don't think the way to get at this is, what's a specific policy that has turned out differently than Xi wanted it to? A, we can't know that right. because we can't get inside the black box. I think a better starting point is, this is a communist party-led system. And unless one's definition of what a communist autocracy is doesn't include the role for the party, the ideas of collective leadership, the idea that there is a relationship between the program to be implemented and the personnel chosen to do the implementation, all of which I think they're not the only characteristics, but they're a part of what it is to be a communist party-led system. That is he first among equals? Yes. Is he the core decision maker? Probably. But he rose to the position at the top of the party in a period that the party describes as a lost decade of paralysis, of declared inability to make coherent, integrated decisions, a need for a decider, if you will, in the terminology of George W. Bush, somebody who could break through the paralysis and organize the activities. The work that I have done on China for now almost 60 years tells me there's a lot of fighting going on all the time, mm-hmm. about exactly how to do things, and coalitions form and dissolve around the issues of the moment and the priorities. And then somebody articulates it. He's the articulator. How much of a thumb he has on the scale because of his position or his personality or deals that he has made in terms of assignments, I don't know. I don't think we can know that given the nature of the system.
It's a very good point. So maybe that is not the best way.
Let me make one more before stopping. And it's worth, I think, standing the idea that he is the all-powerful leader on its head. Because things have not been going very well for pretty much his entire time at the head of the party. Economic growth has gone down steadily. China has become less popular in give or take every country in the world over that period. Life for Chinese has plateaued. What could go on with things that aren't going well? The least worth considering is if you are dissatisfied with the policy mix and concerned about the direction that China is going, and you are in the leadership, having Xi Jinping out in front, he's a scapegoat in waiting. Hey, she screwed up. The party remains solid. Right. Mike,
I guess I agree with all of that and would just add a couple of things. First of all, if you talk to at least many people, particularly in the more urbanized, highly educated, cosmopolitan parts of China, increasingly people say that opinion about China's posture towards the world is divided in, quote, two irreconcilable groups. And so what they say, what we've got is two groups, one voice, with the idea that the one voice is pasting over all of the internal disagreement. So, and I take it seriously when, broadly speaking, when you interact with people in a sort of a truthful private circumstance, you get a much more limited view about how much consensus there is. So that's certainly, I think, one thing. Also, you just look at, you know, the degree of what you might call elite turmoil from the very beginning of the current regime. Guo Xilai on to the recent disappearances and yet still unexplained. So I think what we have is a lot of dots on the final thing is that it's almost the very nature of the expansion of his control throughout his, from the, you know, the norms on succession, but also all the coordinating committees. He's the chairman of every coordinating committee. Well, there are only so many days or hours in a day and days in a week. His span of nominal control greatly exceeds human capacity. So, and then you think about all the, look at all of the accumulation of local debt. That represents the decisions of a whole system largely beyond Beijing's control in many respects, not all respects. So I would just say, look at the evidence.
Excellent. In your paper, you then go after the kind of mechanistic explanations for Chinese behavior, that it's just, for example, another rising power or a great power. The footnote that you have for this fingers, you know, Graham Allison and the idea of Thucydides' trap that he popularized, and John Mearsheimer's piece, the Inevitable Rivalry from Foreign Affairs back in 21. My sense is that the whole discipline of political science, and especially its poor relation, IR, keeps pushing for these sort of ironclad, generalizable theories about state behavior, and that, I think, tends to blinker our thinking. What are your thoughts for why we are so, we seem so prone to embrace these ideas that of kind of deterministic ideas about what drives Chinese foreign policy and domestic policy as well? What is it that, you know, why do we keep getting this wrong and try to impose these sort of theories that don't really fit the facts?
Well, I guess on some of this, I go back to Dwight David Eisenhower and his farewell address to the nation. Mm-hmm. And basically, when security becomes the issue, it dominates all others. And so elites that want to exert control domestically find a very powerful issue in what you might call the bundle of security issues. And Thucydides' trap, the inevitability of the contest between rising and declining powers, is just a perfect theoretical instrument with which to wage bureaucratic politics. And Eisenhower, way before, you know, in 1961, gave his that address, and I would commend it. So I think it's a very useful theory for people waging domestic political fights. Incidentally, not just in the United States. I don't think the PLA is any weaker domestic participant in Chinese politics than the U.S. defense establishment is here. And it isn't just the formal bureaucracies, but society itself through employment, contracting, all of this spreads this interest across society. So I think it's a very useful way to build political support. And also, I think in all fairness, we have to say there is a Thucydides problem, and that is countries do care about their relative status and power and influence. And so there is a contest here. But there also is, interdependence and so forth that are on the other side of the scale that seem to pale once you invoke the Thucydides trap.
So once again, it's this problem of only looking at the situation through the single lens of national security that gives rise to these distortions. Tom, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I agree with what Mike has said. There's also an element of automaticity, the inevitability, the immutability, which removes all agency.
Right.
And I don't believe international relations in the current age, which has everything from nuclear weapons and the possibility of sloppy thinking leading to annihilation, to elements of citizen participation on decision-making. We no longer have kings or emperors that can order their minions into the battlefield for a little distracting war.
Right.
That the economies are so tied up with social stability, every regime has to be, to some extent, responsive and responsible to its people, which increases the need for leadership to make reasoned decisions, not act as if they're automatons in a predetermined interrelationship. The other point I would make is, no slight to my friend Graham Allison and others who have articulated, but the way in which the policymaking elite of the country has glommed on to the resurgence of great power rivalry, as if that is the determining, and all the points Mike made about global challenges that need to be faced. But there's a certain combination of policy inertia and intellectual laziness, which basically said, using the idea of the Thucydides trap to justify great power rivalry as that's the primary problem that we face, and we have a playbook for that. What we need to do is take out Soviet Union and plug China in, and we don't have to change a whole collection of policies and priorities that bumps up against at least what I read as the public mood in the United States, certainly, and elsewhere, that they may have been the right priorities 50 years ago. But to continue to downplay education, social justice, response to climate change, response to a whole series of other problems that we relegated to secondary or tertiary importance, because that rivalry, that military rivalry, the security dimension, had to trump everything else. So I think it's the one hand inertia. Nobody has a better idea or is willing to fight the difficult political battles to reorient and reprioritize how we spend our money and organize our government. And the other is a laziness. If Thucydides said it all, why do we need international relations specialists today? All I have to do is say, me too.
So far, we've talked about three of these caricatures. First, this idea that China is an autocracy and can be understood in that, just simply as that category, and the problems that creates. We've talked about right-sizing Xi Jinping's actual role and the tendency to overestimate, the total domination he has over the political apparatus. A third is this kind of deterministic or mechanistic thinking when it comes to great power competition. And the fourth one that you raise, I think, is a very interesting one. It's actually one that's been very much on my mind recently as I've watched this whole TikTok mess unfold. And it's this idea of China as this unstoppable juggernaut, as you put it. I mean, my you put your finger exactly on what my objection is to this whole TikTok bill. Its proponents, as you say, you know, in another context, see Beijing as acting confidently from a position of strength and often seem to lack confidence in America's strength and resilience. And this is what I'm seeing. You know, this is, we're willing to, you know, become a less open society so that we can preserve what America as an open society. It's very, very odd to me. But let me ask you about one other thing that maybe doesn't fit quite into any of these boxes that you've constructed, but which I hear a lot. And that is this idea that China is hell-bent on recreating the imperial tribute system. I see this a lot, this, you know, Tianxia idea. I know that, you know, it's in the footnotes, but you don't speak directly to this, but books like Rush Doshi's The Long Game or Michael Pillsbury's 100-Year Marathon, they seem to posit this idea that China is bent on recreating an international order, at least in Asia, that is basically a reconstruction of the old Tianxia Imperium. What do you make of that idea?
Well, I'll take a stab at it. I think there are a lot of ways to approach it, but maybe looking at BRI for a minute. And I spent quite a bit of time writing a book on China's building of high-speed rail system in Southeast Asia. And I came to the conclusion that the Chinese, they have many purposes in mind. But as they build out their own infrastructure, they looked for export markets abroad for high-speed railroad, for all the cement and steel they're building. That economic drivers are a big part of the explanation, and employment and so forth. That China has many motivations that are very understandable in geoeconomic terms.
Soaking up excess capacity, right?
And I think if China has an objective, I always remember the guy who talked to me, a Chinese official. He says, you know, in the old days, all roads led to Rome. Well, we hope in economic terms, before too long, all roads in Asia are going to lead to Beijing in economic terms. And China, as it moves up the value-added chain and it becomes more expensive to produce things in China, it offloads investment to Vietnam or Indonesia, India, and so on. So I think China is trying to expand its economic role for very sound domestic reasons and reasons of geopolitical influence. But, you know, if I just stand back and I'm from Mars, how is that different than anybody else's set of motivations? Certainly the United States and the role of the Panama Canal and the Transcontinental Railroad were launching pads for a global initiative, important a dimension of which was economic. So I think China has ambition. I think we have to organize our society to compete on that economic playing field. So I don't deny the aspirations, but I put them in a comparative perspective that don't make them seem sui generis.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So then we get into what I think is the nub of your paper, and perhaps its most valuable insight, this idea of two integrated constellations, two modes, two packages between which China oscillates. One of these prioritizes national and regime security, and the other prioritizes economic and social development. And they always do seem to come together as separate packages. It's interesting how they do cluster like that. I think these two modes can probably be used to describe actually just about any period in China's long history. I mean, I think of, you know, the period of the High Tang from 712 to, say, 755. That's very much in that kind of second constellation. Let's spell these out a little more explicitly. What are the major stars in each of these constellations? Let's start with that first, the national security-focused, regime security-focused constellation.
In the national security focus, which we don't go back to the Tang, we go back to the late Qing in our look at this, but I think you're right that there are antecedents for this, that when the regime has felt threatened, the threatened overthrow of the dynasty, threatened by a a foreign adversary threatened by loss of the mandate, by which I mean loss of popular tolerance for the system. They've emphasized autarky to minimize vulnerabilities that come from some form of dependence or interdependence. They emphasize control over all facets of domestic society. They emphasize, call it ideology, attention to doctrine, performance in accordance with the teachings of Confucius in terms for respect for authority, but use more of the mechanisms of legalism to enforce that control. And the logic of it is, if we don't maintain order, that China has a natural propensity to fly apart. Sun Yat-sen's characterization of the country as a sheet of loose sand that must be held together, that unless vulnerabilities to outside manipulation are minimized, are controlled, or ameliorated, the avaricious and jealous outsiders will exploit them in ways that harm China, harm the Chinese people, impede prosperity. You have to have order in order to have economic growth and development. If maintaining order means you grow more slowly, that's the price. The flip side of that is, as after the Great Leap Forward, as after the Cultural Revolution, when the economy was in such bad shape that people were in some cases suffering, in other cases frustrated by the inability to achieve things that they had come to expect or thought they'd been promised. And with the greater exposure to the world outside China, folks knew that other societies were better off. Then bolstering the economy, meeting public demands and expectations, maintain order, build legitimacy through performance, and managing the threats by getting the people behind us, by skillful use of diplomacy and balance of power techniques to keep the hostile forces at bay, so that you could accelerate or sustain development, and that over time, that would reduce the vulnerability on the security front. And those two lines, I think we would argue, have been there certainly going back into the 19th century, and I agree with you, Kaiser, much earlier.
It's clear enough to me that both of you, and I certainly share this as well, pretty much I think anyone who's invested emotionally or intellectually in China doubtless feels the same. You have a normative preference for that second constellation. So the question that you address really is, why did China shift from that second constellation? It's interesting. I think it sort of maps onto wealth and power too, right? So from the wealth constellation to the power constellation. I've always used sort of tight and loose to think about these two modes. But the big question for me throughout this whole, the whole life of this program, 14 years, because we started in 2010, when it was noticeable that there was a shift underway. And it's been really kind of a leitmotif through the whole life of the show, has been trying to figure out what it was that caused this shift to happen, presumably in the hopes that we could nudge it back, or in the hopes that it would somehow return to that second. So let's take your time. Let's lay out, as you understand it, why this shift happened, when it became noticeable, what the drivers were, both domestic and international, for this move from this more confident, more open, more tolerant, more, I hesitate to say pluralistic, but certainly looser approach that prevailed, to what came after and what still persists today.
Well, I might try to take a stab at that one. I think, first of all, it's useful to sort of have a big conceptual starting point to answer a question sure. like that. And my conceptual starting point was globalization, meaning increasing interaction on all spheres on an increasingly global basis, was a very disruptive process. And many of us in the global cities, whether it was New York or Shanghai, London, the beneficiaries of that were great, widely spread. But in each of our societies and across societies, we didn't pay attention, I think, sufficiently to, I don't want to sound normative or critical, but there were people who were either were absolute losers in that process or saw themselves as relative losers.
Sure.
And therefore, you've got a kind of historical coalition process. The more globalization went on, the more people in each society gained. But losers tend over time to be the squeaky wheels that are more highly motivated to change the situation. Mm. And I think we were not good enough in both societies at seeing where the losers in the, and it isn't just economic losers, it's social status losers. And so I think what you get is over time, when the cycle's on the upswing, you accumulate losers. They finally get enough traction in the system, and they begin to turn policy in a different, more conflictual direction. Now, that cycle's going to go on, it seems to me, for quite a while. And at some point, though, that's going to accumulate a bunch of people, elites, that see themselves as losers, and they will start, I think, to push the cycle the other way. So I guess my starting point would be is globalization was not a neutral process. And so we need to find out who considers themselves to have gained, been the supports for it. Why was each of our systems not sufficiently responsive? And also, I would say, also, each of us began to do things that were legitimately of concern to the other. And I just say one last thing. I think you mentioned TikTok, Kaiser, and it seems to me, you know, the globalized world's very complicated. The U.S. doesn't really have any privacy provisions, not much control over the internet. Well, that was acceptable to Americans when we thought Americans pretty much were dominating that space. But once China can operate in our space with its rules and we're not constraining it, then we begin to react to that. And the government is reacting to a social phenomenon here in the United States. So I think that globalization got our domestic politics interpenetrated in each of our countries, no matter what. And sometimes we do it intentionally. Hillary Clinton in 2010, as I recall, talked about breaching the firewall and reaching directly to the Chinese people. And of course, today you can read in Reuters accusations that China's doing the same thing to us
right now.
So I think we've just, globalization's a big part of this. Hmm.
So just to be clear, I understand the sort of winner-loser dynamic in the United States and certainly how, you know, the rise of sort of right populism happened in the U.S. How are you envisioning this playing out in China? Who are the systemic losers who then are motivated to change China in this point? Who specifically, what segments of society are we talking about?
Well, let me take it and build on. And I mean, Mike was right to start with the big concept. And you know, one way of summarizing on the United States is over the decades of engagement with China and the globalization process writ large, the United States became much wealthier. Our GDP growth over that period is very impressive. Our GDP growth per capita is very impressive, but the distribution became more and more uneven.
Sure.
So the country became wealthier, but most Americans did not. And when it sank in that changes that began in the 1980s, roughly, were not a blip
in a longer process of restoring to, you know, the growth of the middle class and so forth, we got a lot of understandable public discontent. I don't think there's the direct equivalent in China, whether they may be building toward that now. But I think the dynamic in China going to about 2009-10, maybe 2008, as the recognition that the Soviet Union is gone, Russia is not going to play, there's no counterbalance to the United States, that the unipolar moment, the triumphalism of the United States at the end of the Soviet Union, end of the Cold War. For security terms, China had lost an important element of how it could justify the risks of engagement and pursuit of economic purposes. The nature of engagement, that dimension of globalization, where the U.S. outsources the implementation of lots and lots of foreign policy to the private sector, companies, nurses associations, academic organizations, lawyers, whatever it is, to sort of do this thing, build the ties, build the relationship, the economic interdependence, the technological and financial interdependence. If you're sitting in Beijing and you're watching your economic growth slow, those points of vulnerability from interdependence and a judgment that the Americans are unconstrained by a balancing power, that they mirror image, that the United States would do what China would do in a situation like that, which is exploit the vulnerabilities to their own advantage and to China's disadvantage. So a defensively motivated need to reduce the vulnerabilities, tighten control, more autarky in there. That's the back to the future aspect of this, this familiar package of emphasis on security that they had, I think, in my judgment, they had an opportunity to push through for the system high risk next steps of reforms, moving towards an independent judiciary, for example, moving away from the state enterprise domination of the political economy in China. When things were booming, they were afraid to do it. When growth peaked, began to fall, every day looked riskier than the day before for taking these changes. And if it looks riskier, then you have to ramp up the security and the protective elements to it, expecting the people are going to be unhappy. I mean, just take one thing and then I'll stop on this, that after two generations, basically, of one child per family, no siblings, no cousins, no aunts and uncles, still early retirement ages globally. So if you're a young couple, you're looking at having to support four parents and eight grandparents with a really pretty flimsy Social Security safety net under it. You're looking at opportunities to buy housing that is expensive in terms of any place. It's expensive, but you can't, and you need two incomes to buy a house and live reasonably comfortably, but you can't have two incomes if somebody has to stay home and take care of grandma. Right. And if you have kids, that's even more of a problem in it. So for the government, the slower growth, rising demands that are pegged to rising needs of a public, the what can go wrong element in this is almost anything at any time. I think they're running scared. Let me stop that.
Just one thing, Kaiser. I agree with everything Tom said, but just to directly answer, who are the losers in China in this vocabulary? I mean, start with the party, 90-plus million people, and over time and reform, you know, they weren't in the foreign-owned factories. The party wasn't always very effective. they were shrinking in their relatively space the party occupied in important decision-making areas in China. And she came back in with the idea we have to restore the leadership and effectiveness of the party at all levels. So I think you could say many people in the party perceive themselves as losing span of control, just to put it that way. Certainly, when she came in, it was kind of interesting. He went all over the world and was promising infrastructure projects to large numbers of countries. And I began having Chinese come and say, well, it's all very interesting, but we have lots of problems in China. Why are we investing in a poorer, weaker, less stable governments abroad when we have many domestic needs? And so you had that. As China was becoming more globally involved, it took resources away from domestic needs and so forth. You know, also, many of the big SOEs were losers. I mean, they lost to the private sector. Now, some people from the SOEs managed to segue into leading roles in these new quasi-private enterprises. But basically, the SOEs were not winners as normally conceived of state enterprises in the old days. And certain regions that had, like the Northeast, heavy concentrations of SOEs, they weren't always so supportive of globalization as it was playing out for them. So I think bringing what we might call normal tools of analysis to looking at China doesn't get you the whole way analytically, but it gets you some of the way.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that your explanation, your frame just now, coupled with what Susan Cherk puts forward about sort of the dynamics of domestic politics, how this sort of deliberately collective leadership had given rise to, you know, these basically personal satrapies just nested within major industrial sectors, how it had become so rife with corruption. Fantastic. I think it's a very valuable contribution. One thing I wanted to ask you about, though, you didn't talk too much directly about this in your piece, was what happened in the years from roughly, you know, 2001 for the next, say, 7 or 8 years, where it was sort of the peak of that second constellation in China, the peak of, we jokingly call it the golden age of Hu Jintao. In some ways, I think you look at the turn of the millennium, actually you could go back and start in, you know, the winter of 95 and early 96 from, you know, the third Taiwan Straits crisis, to the Falun Gong protests, to the embassy bombing, to the EP3 spy plane incident, and then to the release of the U.S. national security strategy. And we see that the relationship is looking to be headed in a very bad direction. But then September 11th happens, and it seems to me, from where I was living in Beijing, you know, from 96 to 2016, so I was witness to a lot of this, but after September 11th, everything really, really changed. I was talking to Mike about this just before we started recording, but I look at that period, and it's hard to actually find anything that really perturbed U.S.-China relations. I mean, you had that constant sort of chorus coming out of Chuck Schumer and Lindsey Graham's offices about currency revaluation. You had Darfur, I suppose. But besides those things, the rest was drywall or poisoned pet food. There wasn't really a huge issue. Even things like Tibet had receded quite a bit during that honeymoon period. Now, I've always argued that a big part of the reason why China felt comfortable in this sort of second constellation mode for as long as it did was it did not feel it was in the American crosshairs in any meaningful way. You had, sure, this doctrine of preemption, the height of neoconservative ascendancy is during the same time. So you'd think China might feel threatened, but I don't think that they ever saw the sort of George W. Bush, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz doctrine as having China in mind. It was for, you know, tin pot dictatorships, right? It wasn't about China. But that really changes, strangely, when the Obama administration comes in. So I'm curious what you think about this. Because to me, it's always seemed like this is a pretty strong argument for a less is more approach when it comes to China. The less we are focused on China, the more it remains comfortably in that second mode. It's more tolerant. It's more sort of loose in that sense that I've been describing. What do you make of this idea?
Well, I'll give it a, give it a shot. First of all, there's a lot of, I will say, luck and serendipity in history, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you think back to when George W. Bush came into office and Condoleezza Rice was the security advisor and she'd written a piece for Foreign Affairs, it was kind of clear that there was a strategic skepticism that the new administration was going to have towards China. And I think the Chinese were worried about that. But lo and behold, 9/11 comes along. And you'll remember President George W. Bush said, "You're with us or against us." And this is where leaders matter. Xi Jinping was a very deft person to deal with George W. Bush. And he had the background to do it. And he was practically the first guy on the phone to Bush, essentially saying, "I'm with you." And 9/11 changed the street, as the U.S. Ambassador Sandy Rant came to Seitz. And he started his speech by saying, "We've seen the," this is post 9/11, "we've seen the enemy, and it's not China." And Rant was Bush's roommate in school. So I think that's pretty much, so that nipped in the bud, I think, the total strategic turnaround that could have happened had that not happened. So I think that's clearly one thing. The other thing is, I think Chen Shui-bian in Taiwan completely misplayed his hand and scared the heck out of George W. Bush that he was going to create another crisis with military dimensions at the other end of the world. And that was not acceptable to George W. Bush. And he came down in a very credible way in the presence of Wen Jiabao and said, "We're not going to support anybody who upsets the status quo in the Taiwan Straits." And I think that was credible. And I think Taiwan is, you know, one of the major concerns China has. So the point is, in the strategic area, we each reassured the other in the area we were most worried about. China reassured we weren't going to do something that was totally unacceptable in the Taiwan Strait. And then Ma Ying-jeou came along, and there was lots of interaction across the strait. And China reassured us that it would be helpful, limited to be sure, on the strategic front on terrorism. And remember, immediately there was an agreement with FBI being able to put people in Shanghai to look at containers because we were afraid of what might come in through all these containers and globalization in American harbors. So I think it's much more complicated than that. But the point is, we each reassured each other at a critical point that we were not strategically antagonistic.
The age of those sorts of reassurances, though, to be at least, if not over, at least kind of a big reach from where we are today. Our goal, I think, plainly enough, is to try to create conditions whereby, you know, we can reestablish that kind of mutual reassurance. For me personally, I want to see China return to that more, you know, tolerant and outward-facing, more cosmopolitan, more gentle China. And I should add that, you know, wanting China to be that way, it isn't some Western fantasy or an imposition of Western values. I mean, as we all know, plenty of Chinese people really, really want that as well. What should we do then? I mean, your paper argues, I think correctly, that at the very least, let's observe the first law of holes, right? Stop digging. What constitutes right now still digging? What are we doing that you would say is still digging while we're in the hole?
I'll take it first, but let me segue from the discussion that we had a moment ago. Having spent almost a quarter century in senior jobs in Washington, that my observation is most of the time over that period, China was not at the top of the administration agenda. China policy got set, really, in the Carter administration. People inside the executive branch, the legislative branch, the private sector, understood what it was, the military's notion of commander's intent, that develop as many relationships, mutually productive relationships, as possible with a lot of latitude to work that out. And that the multiplicity without a major great design was the way we want to do it. That at the top of any system, it's, you know, the span of control problem that Mike has raised a couple of times. It exists on both sides. And the U.S. is a global actor that had to worry about all of the other things going on. China increasingly is a global, has global interests and has to pay attention to things around the world. Only so many things you can manage at the top of any system. And during the halcyon period that you referred to, when reform was charging ahead and the relationship was quite smooth, that the American plate was full. That and it was about war on terror. It was about Korean nuclear developments. It was about some problems in Africa and the Middle East, about economic problems in South America, that the problems that had been festering in terms of Chinese failure to follow through on WTO commitments, on bilateral trade commitments, on corporate agreements, the beginnings of demands for transfers of technology, firms wanted to sell products or produce in China, these kind of things that were there. And in that period, the business sector was still basically saying to the government, stay out of it. Don't politicize this. Let us work this. That shifted over time to the point where they said, we don't want to expend, take the corporate risk that it would require. You, American government, fix it for everybody. Right. And that was a big shift in terms of what went after. I'm not blaming China as the origin of all problems in the relationship. Clearly, both sides are culpable here. But the period where things just sort of operated because China was not in the crosshairs, we were not in China's crosshairs either. To my knowledge, China, the party, still adheres to the Leninist dictum that Mao articulated several times, that war between the imperialists and the socialist world is inevitable. And he proceeded inevitable and imminent. And Deng turned it around. Deng said, it's inevitable, but not imminent. We can keep it off with, you know, clever policies and embrace our enemy, hold them closer, all that kind of stuff. But the inevitability of the camp led by the United States in trying to bring about regime change by force is still there. We don't have that kind of thing. The closest we come is the idea that China has a master plan and is playing this out, so we ought to trip them up before they get a chance to implement their master plan. And regime change is an objective for which we actually don't do very much. In terms of policy. So with this is the lead up. Most of the time, China looks at us much more closely than we look at them. That the starting point assumption in my experience with China is anything the United States does, for whatever reason, whatever problem anywhere in the world, responding to domestic pressures that could conceivably have an adverse impact on China, must have been adopted with a specific objective of bringing down the regime,
right,
or crippling the economy. And you go, no, not really. But
of course that, not.
But we don't pay enough attention to how the Chinese perceive and respond to things that we do around the world in the bilateral relationship, in our unofficial media, that, you know, anybody can say anything, however outrageous, about China or anything else. That's construed, or can be construed, often is in China, by political actors, as that's the true intent of the Americans. Understand what they're about, and it plays into their domestic politics. So in the first law of Holes, be more careful about what was officially. We can't control the unofficial noise that is out there, but let's not be gratuitously provocative, that we don't have to comment on everything that China does or say. We don't have to say ad hominem things about Xi Jinping or any other Chinese leader officially on this. And we should be, and I'll flip it to Mike here, and we should be much clearer than we have been for almost 10 years about what our policies are on issues that matter to China and affect both of us.
And especially Taiwan, I imagine you have in mind.
Yes.
Mike?
I think I'd respond to, I agree with what Tom has said, but home in on what are the specifics in the first law of Holes, stop digging. And several occur to me. First of all, I think one of the big strategic blunders that China has made, they should stop digging holes too, right?
Absolutely.
This is a mutual problem we've got here. I think the biggest single hole in recent times that China's dug is in connection with the Winter Olympics in 2022. And Putin goes to Beijing and they sign the cooperative No Limits Partnership. And 3 weeks later, Ukraine gets invaded. That looks to Americans an awful lot like 1950.
Right.
And the outbreak of the Korean War. And it also goes against to what had always been the most reassuring part of China's, let's say, open policy, was the sanctity of borders. Well, this was a pretty big violation of the core principle of Chinese foreign policy.
Absolutely.
And Americans would have expected earlier on, in the case of Georgia, I think it was in 2008, I think it was, China separated itself from Russian pressure on Georgia. That won wide strategic approval in the U.S. So I think China dug a real big hole here. And the administration, I don't speak for them by any means, but I understand that they are very vigilant about all the dimensions of cooperation, direct and indirect, between China and Russia in the context of the Ukraine war. And the worse Ukraine does, and we hope, you know, we can speculate about how Ukraine will do in the future, but the more problems Ukraine has, the more sensitive China's relationship to Russia in that context gets here. So I want to make it clear, we're not, and the Americans aren't the only ones digging the hole here.
No, absolutely not.
And I think that was a big one. The second thing is, I think Americans kind of look at, in terms of digging holes, the big picture. And the Americans say, now, you know, the United States was pretty helpful to China's rise economically. The bulk of the credit, of course, goes to the Chinese people. But the United States, on balance, played a useful role in opening its markets, its universities, and so forth. And yet now what we see increasingly in terms of alliance behavior is China seems closer to, or at least getting closer to, Iran, DPRK, Russia.
A rogues gallery.
And of course, the Americans, they see the big picture here. And so then they ask themselves, well, what could account for that? Because self-evidently, Russia's not the economic future of the world.
That's right.
So we just have a first-order problem understanding what China's doing strategically. So I would say that U.S., just one big hole the U.S. is digging. I've got to say, I'm quite worried about the nibbling away at the One China policy. The fact that China, I think, at least not without reason, wonders whether we now have a One Taiwan, One China policy. And that, I think, has obviously, since 1971, when Kissinger first went, Taiwan has always been the most delicate issue, and the U.S. is engaged in a whole series of activities that have nibbled around the norms. Now, once again, it's more complicated than just the U.S. China's been up in the heat coercion, we would say,
sure,
both economic and military on Taiwan. So China's not blameless here. But the U.S. is scraping at that scab of the Taiwan wound in a way that I think is very dangerous. And our Assistant Secretary of Defense has, in front of the Congress, talked about Taiwan being the linchpin in the strategic position of the U.S. in Asia. That sounds a lot like MacArthur and aircraft carriers to the Chinese. So
significantly, though, he has not brought that up again since 21 when Eli Ratner first said that.
Right. Let me ask you, though, Kaiser, do you think the Chinese forgot he said that?
No, but I think they should read significance into the fact that it has not been repeated, that we've seen sort of unanswered dressing down of him publicly from a lot of people, where nobody has come to his defense in that. I think that's significant, and I hope China understands that. And on that topic of Chinese understanding, to come back to what Tom was saying, yeah, they do spend an awful lot of time. They do get us wrong an awful lot. They do conflate, I think, what are, you know, unofficial sources. What we're seeing is expressions of commonly held American values in different sectors that are not official, and they act in a way that looks from Beijing like coordination, when it is, we know well enough that we'd be incapable of that kind of coordination, and it's not what it is. So I'm often, and this is something that I'm going to be talking to a number of Chinese foreign policy experts on the United States about in coming weeks, but we are now having this conversation just a couple of days after both Trump and Biden cinched their party's nominations for the presidency. So we've officially entered silly season. And I wonder whether your counterparts in Beijing, people who are in academia or at think tanks and advisory bodies to the State Council or to the Foreign Ministry, do they know how much they should be discounting what gets said between now and November? I mean, I found myself in conversation with Chinese friends to explain, for example, that recent Biden order on electric vehicles. It wasn't even about electric vehicles, about smart vehicles, in which, you know, he talked about the big three automakers and how they were going to exclude Chinese smart vehicles. And people were perplexed and asking me to explain that. I said, that's actually about October 7th. This is because, you know, in the Michigan primary, so many Arab American voters in cities like Dearborn just filled in that little oval that says not committed. You know, 81% voted for Biden, but 19% filled in that non-committed, which is very significant. And then, you know, and this was as a reaction to Biden policies in Israel and Gaza. And so, I mean, to explain this to them, to say, you know, that therefore he needs to throw a bone to the UAW, which, you know, is already seeing a lot of people peel off from, you know, the pressures of right populism. It's complicated, right, to explain that. But I think a lot of sophisticated Chinese political analysts get this. I don't know how much of it is filtering up, though. Do you have a sense for that?
Well, I preface the sense for what the Chinese have by saying the vast majority of Americans, even American intellectuals, don't understand kind of what's going on, as you put it, in the silly season and the paying attention for political reasons to lots of things. So I think, you know, the best of China's America specialists have a pretty good understanding of us. I think they have a terribly difficult time talking to the people who need to know about that for operational purposes. That, again, until somebody has served high up in anybody's system to realize how all-consuming the everyday inbox events are, how much you need to know, except for those who are responsible for dealing with America policy in China, everything else is more important. So it's a real problem. Beyond the silly seas, though, we've got something that I think is going to persist beyond the election. And that is, in our political environment, where we need to make a number of costly and contentious decisions, mostly on domestic, but also on international affairs, the perceived, or certainly exercised as if the perceived utility of doing this because of the China threat helps justify the desired action. We need universal preschool education to deal with the threat from China. We probably need universal preschool education for lots of reasons. Well, what one? This, you know, that's right. Try to make China threat the equivalent of the Soviet Union and Sputnik, that to justify lots of things that we probably ought to be doing. And sort of if you're inside the Beltway and you play this game, you understand that's what's going on. If you're in China, even if you're a Chinese America specialist, it looks like we're coming to get them. Everything we do is aimed at them. And I don't know how you turn that off, because it's useful to get things done.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, but I think there's the old saw that even paranoids have enemies, right?
Yeah.
And so I would say if I was in Beijing, and I would try to have some indicators of underlying momentum in the American system. Where is it headed, almost irrespective of year-to-year perturbation? And I think you could look, for instance, at budgetary trajectory. Just look at where our National Defense Authorization Acts have been headed for quite a few years, and what we had a 7-8% budgetary military increase in the last fiscal year. China's got about the same percentage increase, at least publicly released. So we're both have a very big budgetary momentum going here, and that's kind of baked into both of our domestic politics keeks as well as strategic assessment. So we certainly have that. Also, it seems to me that if I was the Chinese, another big indicator would be the Republicans and Democrats don't agree about anything except China.
Right, right.
Right? You've got to explain that. And it looks like a pretty solid consensus. And then if you look at public opinion polls and just generalized sense of threat in both our societies, as nearly as we can tell, but certainly in the U.S., the sense of threat's been going up and the two parties converge. So, and then you look at, we're both going to industrial policy.
Yeah. One's already been there, but yeah.
That's fundamental to both of our economies. So, yeah, yes, I think, you know, we can each discount each other's bureaucratic games and so forth that we should do. But the underlying trends are not reassuring for strategic comedy, let's put it that way.
Let me, if I could, Kaiser, pick up. This is a chance to stitch together several points in our conversation. That the universal dislike of China within liberals, conservatives, Democrats, Republicans that Mike described accurately. One of the consequences of that, implications of that, is Biden now, if he's reelected, if we have a second Trump administration, is that's there as an impediment to doing things. The United States might take the initiative. We're the bigger guy. We should be the more confident guy to take the steps to defuse the tensions in the relationship. Doing anything that would meet that kind of criterion is sure to spark a backlash within all the factions of both parties in this and get in the way of achieving higher priority objectives for, again, the current administration or a successor. So that to expect a near-term dramatic move by the United States to improve relations, I think is unrealistic in terms of our politics.
Yeah.
For the reasons in our article, expecting a dramatic shift on policies that we find offensive, that would improve the bilateral relationship from China, is also unrealistic because they are so intertwined with this protection set. And among the things that would have to happen, in my judgment, they'd have to break with this, with Moscow.
Right.
Because the domestic package hangs off of that. The personnel assignments hang off of that. So we're in the current unrewarding, unhelpful, distressing, maybe even to an extent dangerous situation for the foreseeable future. So managing it is going to become the highest priority, it should be.
You do make some suggestions for low-hanging fruit that could at least start us on the path to, you know, maybe build cooperation spirals. I don't know if you're familiar with Lyle Goldstein's book, Meeting China Halfway, but he actually lays out some, I think, very, you know, smart, actionable ideas about explicitly reciprocal steps that each side might take toward rebuilding trust with the other. One that you talk about is the reopening of the Houston and Chengdu consulates. I mean, often things like reestablishing the Fulbright scholarships, maybe reopening Peace Corps operations in China, maybe not going so hard against some of the CIs, the Confucius Institutes in the United States, things like that. Yeah, I share your pessimism, but you know that goes against the fiber of my nature. So I'm always looking for the silver lining or the way forward. I trust that, you know, you two aren't defeated entirely by the grim
outlook. That's why we wrote it.
We're the optimists.
Yeah.
And we've always been.
Yeah. No,
it's fantastic
to have you on our side.
Yeah. Just one thing that, Tom and I, as I recall, haven't talked about this, so I wonder what he would think as well. But we may have a strategic opportunity that's hard to see right at the moment, but I think it's there. And that is that what's going on in Gaza is an unmitigated human disaster and political disaster for both of us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And we ought to find a way to cooperate to put this cork back in the bottle. You know, I think we both subscribe, broadly speaking, to a two-state solution. We both see the humanitarian catastrophe of this thing. China would like to, you know, is trying to increase its attractiveness in the Middle East, including with Saudi Arabia, not the least. And we need all the help we can. And clearly the administration's willing to separate itself somewhat from the current administration in Tel Aviv. So I don't know what may be going on behind the scenes, but I would think maybe here's an area we could actually cooperate in the United Nations and elsewhere to do something seen as positive in a horrific circumstance.
Well, let's really hope so. I want to thank you both, Tom Fingar and Mike Lampton, for joining me on Seneca. Let's move on now to the recommendations segment of the show. Before I do that, let me quickly say thank you once again to the University of Wisconsin-Madison Center for East Asian Studies for their generous support of the show this year. All right, on to recommendations. Tom, why don't you start? Do you have a good book? Or...
Sure. I do a lot of reading. That I committed when I was a grad student to read a book a week. That was
something
outside, and I've actually done a pretty good job of that. Two authors that I like, and they're quite different. One is Mick Herron, mm-hmm. Who's a British author described by many as the...
I love Slow Horses, right?
Yes, that series, plus he's got other series. I think they're cleverly written. They're jaded.
Yeah, very much.
Jaded about the British intelligence and security apparatus, but they're fun. To read. So I guess he's got about 20 books, and I'd recommend any of that.
Wow.
Very different and very much darker are the books of Alan First.
I love them too, yeah.
He writes about on the eve of World War II or the early years of World War II that individuals doing heroic things to absolutely no point.
Right.
Sense of being there that he creates in these novels makes them well worth reading. Even you have to admire humanity as individuals and lament this process, the system in which they, therefore we, operate.
So do you have a favorite first novel? I mean, I would go with A Polish Officer, maybe.
It is a very good one, because I can't, Soldiers at Midnight.
Oh, also excellent.
That, if you need two favorites, there it is.
Okay, fantastic. Wonderful, wonderful. Such good recommendations. You know, it's funny, because it's actually Jan Barris who turned me on to Alan First.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so Mike, you've worked with her for years and years at National
Theatre.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mike, what do you have for us?
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to be less erudite and broad-ranging and more narrowly focused. I'm reading a book now that's terrific by Philip Taubman called In the Nation's Service. It's about George Shultz. Oh. And I had the opportunity throughout my career to meet him. But I remember, here's a, you know, been a very successful diplomat. And his signature phrase was, and I saw him get awarded the Dwight David Eisenhower Award in New York City. And he got up and he didn't make a long speech. He said, in the affairs of man, trust is coin of the realm.
Mm-hmm.
And this book is really the story about how he developed his style of dealing with people, how it reflected where he grew up and his formative experiences and the people he knew. And I take him to Ben along. He had a good, he had a president that that he could work well with, but he's one of the most effective diplomats and public servants in the United States. So I've always enjoyed throughout my life reading biographies. The other will sound a little offbeat, but struck me, and that's by Liz Cheney.
Oh.
Her book, Oath and Honor. And I don't know any other circumstances where I would have recommended her book out of all the possibilities. But at this moment, I think it's a good reaffirmation on the importance of institutions and how important the central task of a political system is, the peaceful transfer of power, and how fragile that is. And I think that's a lesson China could learn, as well as us, but particularly poignant now. So I'm kind of in the phase of my thinking of, where do we see leadership of the past that can help us get through what I think is going to be a very challenging, perhaps dangerous period in the future?
Excellent recommendations. Thank you. I have not read Liz Cheney's book yet, and I will put that on my list. I'm not totally ready to forgive her yet, but getting there. So, you know, Tom, you talked about biography, and I'm also very much interested in biography, but I read a very quirky take on that genre. It's actually a novel called The Magician by an Irish writer named Colm Tobin. He's a playwright and a novelist. He now teaches at Columbia. But he's actually served for several years as the chancellor of the University of Liverpool. This book is actually a fictionalized book, but it's very much historically grounded. It's based very much on the diaries of Thomas Mann, the author of, you know, Death in Venice and the Bundabooks and of course, The Magic Mountain. Bundabooks is his first novel, written very, very early, but The Magic Mountain is maybe what he's best known for in Death in Venice. It's a genre I haven't really encountered before, a fictional biography, but it only in that it's novelistic in its writing. But it is apparently entirely based on what's sort of factually provable. And I don't actually know of biographies that can do what this does, which I think is really take you into the head of this subject from, you know, recreating actual dialogue and things like that. It's just a phenomenal, phenomenal read. So The Magician by Colm Tobin, about the life of Thomas Mann, the great German writer. Well, thank you, gentlemen, once again. What a pleasure it's been to talk to you. And I cannot commend your paper more highly. It's called China's America Policy, Back to the Future, and it's in the Winter 2024 volume of Washington Quarterly. Highly suggest you read it. It's available for free to download online. Thank you once more.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Kaiser.
You've been listening to the Cynical Podcast. The show is produced, recorded, engineered, edited, and mastered by me, Kaiser Guo. Support the show through Substack at cynica.substack.com, where there is a growing offering of terrific original China-related writing and audio. Email me at cynicapod@gmail.com if you've got ideas on how you can help out or how I can improve the show. And don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Enormous gratitude to the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Center for East Asian Studies for supporting the show this year. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.